Stephen suggested to Harvey that they should return to the Clarendon building, as it would be discourteous to be late for the Vice-Chancellor.
Sure. Harvey glanced at his watch. Jesus, it's 4:30 already.
They left the garden party and walked quickly down toward the Clarendon building at the bottom of the Broad, Stephen explaining en route that the Clarendon was a sort of Oxford White House, where all the officers and officials of the university had their rooms. The Clarendon is a large, imposing 18th-century building which could be mistaken by a visitor for another college. A few steps lead up to an impressive hallway, and on entering you realise you are in a magnificent old building which has been converted for use as offices, with as few changes as possible. When they arrived, the porter greeted them.
"The Vice-Chancellor is expecting us," said Stephen.
The porter had been somewhat surprised when Robin had arrived 15 minutes earlier and told him that Mr. Habakkuk had asked him to wait in his room. Even though Robin was in full academic dress, the porter kept a beady eye on him, not expecting the Vice-Chancellor or any of his staff to return from the garden party for at least another hour. The arrival of Stephen gave him a little more confidence. He well remembered the pound he had received for his guided tour of the building. The porter ushered Stephen and Harvey through to the Vice-Chancellor's rooms and left them alone, tucking another pound note into his pocket. The Vice-Chancellor's room was in no way pretentious, and its beige carpet and pale walls would have given it the look of any middle-ranking civil servant's office, had it not been for the magnificent picture of a village square in France by Wilson Steer, which hung over the marble fireplace. Robin was staring out of the vast windows overlooking the Bodleian Library.
"Good afternoon, Vice-Chancellor."
Robin spun around.
"Oh, welcome, Professor. You remember Mr. Metcalf?" "Yes, indeed. How nice to see you again."
Robin shuddered. All he wanted to do was to go home. They chatted for a few minutes. Another knock and Jean-Pierre entered.
"Good afternoon, Registrar."
"Good afternoon, Vice-Chancellor. Professor Potter."
"May I introduce Mr. Harvey Metcalf?"
"Good afternoon, sir."
"Registrar, would you like some..."
"Where's this man Metcalf?"
The three of them stood, stunned, as a man looking 90 entered the room on sticks. He hobbled over to Robin, winked, bowed and said,
"Good afternoon, Vice-Chancellor,"
in a loud, crotchety voice.
"Good afternoon," hoarsely.
James went over to Harvey and prodded him with his sticks, as if to make sure he was real.
"I have read about you, young man."
Harvey had not been called young man for 30 years. The others stared at James in admiration. None of them knew that in his last year at university, James had played Lavare to great acclaim. His Secretary of the Chest was simply a repeat performance, and even Molière would have been pleased with it. James continued,
"You have been most generous to Harvard." "That's very kind of you to mention it, sir," said Harvey respectfully.
"Don't call me sir, young man. I like the look of you."
"Call me Horsley."
"Yes, Horsley, sir,"
blurted Harvey. The others were only just able to keep a straight face.
"Well, Vice-Chancellor," continued James, "you can't have dragged me halfway across the city for my health. What's going on? Where's Miss Sherry?"
Stephen wondered if James was overdoing it, but looking at Harvey, saw that he was evidently captivated by the scene. How could a man so mature in one field be so immature in another, he thought. He was beginning to see how Westminster Bridge had been sold to at least 4 Americans in the past 20 years.
"Well, we were hoping to interest Mr. Metcalf in the work of the university, and I felt that the Secretary of the University Chest should be present."
"What's this chest?" asked Harvey.
"Sort of treasurer for the university," replied James, his voice loud, old and very convincing. "Why don't you read this?"
And he thrust into Harvey's hand an Oxford University calendar, which Harvey could have obtained at Blackwell's bookshop for £2, as indeed James had. Stephen was not sure what move to make next, when happily for him, Harvey took over.
"Gentlemen, I would like to say how proud I am to be here today. This has been a wonderful year for me. I was present when an American won Wimbledon. I finally obtained a Van Gogh. My life was saved by a wonderful, wonderful surgeon in Monte Carlo, and now here I am in Oxford, surrounded by all this history. Gentlemen, it would give me a great deal of pleasure to be associated with this famous university."
James took the lead again. "What have you in mind?" he shouted at Harvey, adjusting his hearing aid.
"Well, sir, I achieved my life's ambition when I received the King George and Elizabeth Trophy from your queen. But the prize money, well, I would like to use that to make a benefaction to your university."
"But that's over £80,000," gasped Stephen.
£81,240, to be exact, sir. But why don't I call it £250,000?"
Stephen, Robin and Jean-Pierre were speechless. James alone was left to command the day. This was the opportunity he had needed to show why his great-grandfather had been one of Wellington's most respected generals.
"We accept, but it would have to be anonymous,"
said James. "I think I can safely say, in the circumstances, that the Vice-Chancellor would inform Mr. Harold Macmillan and Hebdomadal Council, but we would not want a fuss made of it. Of course, Vice-Chancellor, I would ask you to consider an honorary degree."
Robin was so conscious of James's obvious control of the entire situation that he could only add,
"How would you recommend we go about it, Horsley?"
"Cash check, so nobody can trace the money back to Mr. Metcalf. We can't have those bloody men from Cambridge chasing him for the rest of his life. Same way as we did for Sir David. No fuss."
"I agree," said Jean-Pierre, not having the vaguest idea what James was talking about. Neither, for that matter, had Harvey. James nodded to Stephen, who left the Vice-Chancellor's office and made his way to the porter's room to inquire if a parcel had been left for Sir John Betjeman.
"Yes, sir. I don't know why they left it here. I'm not expecting Sir John."
"Don't worry," said Stephen. "He's asked me to pick it up for him." Stephen returned to find James holding forth to Harvey on the importance of keeping his donation as a bond between himself and the university. Stephen undid the box and took out the magnificent gown of a Doctor of Letters. Harvey turned red with embarrassment and pride as Robin placed it on his shoulders, chanting some Latin, which was nothing more than his old school motto. The ceremony was completed in a few moments.
"Many congratulations," bellowed James. "A pity we could not have organized this to be part of today's ceremony, but for such a munificent gesture as yours, we could hardly wait another year."
"Brilliant," thought Stephen. "Laurence Olivier could not have done better."
"That's fine by me," said Harvey, as he sat down and made out a check to cash. "You have my word that this matter will never be mentioned to anyone."
None of them believed that. They stood in silence as Harvey rose and passed the check to James.
"No, sir."
James transfixed him with a glare. The others looked dumbfounded.
"The Vice-Chancellor."
"Of course," said Harvey. "Excuse me, sir."
"Thank you," said Robin, his hand trembling as he received the check. "A most gracious gift, and you may be sure we shall put it to good use." There was a loud knock on the door. They all looked around terrified, except for James, who was now ready for anything. It was Harvey's chauffeur. James had always hated the pretentious white uniform with the white hat.
"Ah, the efficient Mr. Mellor," said Harvey. "Gentlemen, I guarantee he's been watching every move we've made today."
The four froze, but the chauffeur had clearly made no sinister deductions from his observations.
"Your car is ready, sir. You wanted to be back at Claridge's by 7 p.m. to be in good time for your dinner appointment."
"Young man," bellowed James.
"Yes, sir," whimpered the chauffeur.
"Do you realize you are in the presence of the Vice-Chancellor of this university?"
"No, sir. I'm very sorry, sir."
"Take your hat off immediately."
"Yes, sir."
The chauffeur removed his hat and retreated to the car, swearing under his breath.
"Vice-Chancellor, I sure hate to break up our party, but as you've heard, I do have an appointment."
"Of course, of course. We understand you're a busy man. May I once again officially thank you for your most generous donation, which will be used to benefit many deserving people. We all hope you have a safe journey back to the States, and will remember us as warmly as we shall remember you," added Jean-Pierre.
Harvey moved toward the door.
"I will take my leave of you now, sir," shouted James. "It will take me 20 minutes to get down those damned steps. You are a fine man, and you have been most generous."
"It was nothing," said Harvey expansively.
True enough, thought James. Nothing to you. Stephen, Robin, and Jean-Pierre accompanied Harvey from the Clarendon to the waiting rolls.
Professor, said Harvey, I didn't quite understand everything the old guy was saying.
As he spoke, he shifted the weight of his heavy robes on his shoulders self-consciously. Well, he's very deaf and very old, but his heart's in the right place. He wanted you to know that this has to be an anonymous donation as far as the university is concerned, though, of course, the Oxford hierarchy will be informed of the truth. If it were to be made public, all sorts of undesirables who have never done anything for education in the past would come trooping along on the day of Insignia wanting to buy an honorary degree.
Of course, I understand. That's fine by me, said Harvey. I want to thank you for a swell day, Rod, and I wish you all the luck for the future. What a shame our friend Wiley Barker wasn't here to share it all.
Robin blushed. Harvey climbed into the Rolls-Royce and waved enthusiastic to the three of them as they watched the car start effortlessly on its journey back to London. Three down and one to go.
James was brilliant, said Jean-Pierre. When he first came in, I didn't know who the hell it was.
I agree, said Robin. Let's go and rescue him. He's truly the hero of the day. They all three ran up the steps, forgetting that they looked somewhere between the ages of 50 and 60, and rushed back into the Vice-Chancellor's room to congratulate James, who lay silent in the middle of the floor. He had passed out. In Magdalen, an hour later, with the help of Robin and two large whiskies, James was back to his normal health.
You were fantastic, said Stephen, just at the point when I was beginning to lose my nerve.
You would have received an Academy Award if we could have put it on screen, said Robin. Your father will have to let you go on the stage after that performance.
James basked in his first moment of glory for 3 months. He could not wait to tell Anne.
Anne. He quickly looked at his watch. 6:30. Oh, hell, I must leave at once. I meant to be meeting Anne at 8. See you all next Monday in Stephen's rooms for dinner. By then I'll try to have my plan ready.
James rushed out of the room.
James?
His face reappeared around the door. They all said in chorus, Fantastic. He grinned, ran down the stairs and leaped into his Alfa Romeo, which he now felt they might allow him to keep, and headed toward London at top speed. It took him 59 minutes from Oxford to the King's Road. The new motorway had made a considerable difference since his undergraduate days. Then the journey had taken anything from an hour and a half to 2 hours through High Wycombe or Henley. The reason for his haste was that the meeting with Anne was most important, and under no circumstances must he be late. Tonight he was due to meet her father. All James knew about him was that he was a senior member of the diplomatic corps in Washington. Diplomats always expect you to be on time. He was determined to make a good impression on her father, particularly after Anne's successful weekend at Tathwell Hall. The old man had taken to her at once and never left her side. They had even managed to agree on a wedding date, subject, of course, to the approval of Anne's parents. James had a quick cold shower and removed all his makeup, losing some 60 years in the process. He had arranged to meet Anne for a drink at Les Ambassadeurs in Mayfair before dinner, and as he put on his dinner jacket, he wondered if he could make it from the King's Road to Hyde Park Corner in 12 minutes. It would require another Monte Carlo. He leaped into his car, revving it quickly through the gears, shot along to Sloane Square, through Eaton Square, up past St. George's Hospital, around Hyde Park Corner into Park Lane, and arrived at 7:58 p.m.
"Good evening, my lord," said Mr. Mills, the club owner.
"Good evening. I'm dining with Miss Summerton, and I've had to leave my car double-parked. Can you take care of it?"
said James, dropping the keys and a pound note into the doorman's white-gloved hand.
"Delighted, my lord. Show Lord Briggsley to the private rooms."
James followed the head porter up the red staircase and into a small Regency room, where dinner had been laid for three. He could hear Anne's voice in the next room. She came through, looking even more beautiful than usual in a floating mint-green dress.
"Hello, darling. Come on, I want you to meet Daddy."
James followed Anne into the next room.
"Daddy, this is James. James, this is my father."
James went red and then white, and then he felt green.
"How are you, my boy? I've heard so much about you from Rosalie that I can't wait to get acquainted."
Chapter 17.
Call me Harvey.
James stood aghast and speechless. Anne jumped into the silence.
Would you like a whiskey, James?
James found his voice with difficulty.
Thank you. I want to know all about you, young man, continued Harvey. What you get up to and why I've seen so little of my daughter in the past few weeks. Though I think I can guess the answer to that.
James drank the whiskey in one gulp and then quickly refilled his glass.
You see so little of your daughter because I'm always modeling, which means that I'm very rarely in London.
I know, Rosalie.
James knows me as Anne, Daddy.
We christened you Rosalie. It was a good enough name for your mother and me, and it ought to be good enough for you.
Daddy, whoever heard of a top European model calling herself Rosalie Metcalf? All my friends know me as Anne Somerton.
What do you think, James?
I was beginning to think I didn't know her at all, replied James, recovering slowly.
It was obvious that Harvey did not suspect a thing. He had not seen James face to face at the gallery. He had never seen him at Monte Carlo or Ascot, and James had looked 90 years of age at Oxford earlier in the day. He was beginning to believe he had got away with it. But how the hell could he tell the others at their Monday meeting that the final plan, his plan, would be to outwit not Harvey Metcalf, but his future father-in-law?
Shall we go through to dinner?
Harvey did not wait for a reply. He marched on into the adjoining room.
Rosalie Metcalf, whispered James fiercely. You've got some explaining to do.
Anne kissed him gently on the cheek.
You're the first person who's given me the chance to beat my father at anything. Can't you forgive me? I do love you.
Come on, you two. Anyone would think you'd never met before.
Anne and James joined Harvey for dinner. James was amused by the sight of the shrimp cocktail and remembered how Stephen had regretted that touch at Harvey's maudlin dinner.
Well, James, I understand you and Anne have fixed a date for the wedding.
Yes, sir, if it meets with your approval.
Of course I approve. I was hoping Anne would marry Prince Charles after I'd won the King George and Elizabeth stakes, but an earl will have to do for my only daughter.
They both laughed, neither of them thinking it was remotely funny.
I wish you'd come to Wimbledon this year, Rosalie. Imagine me there on Ladies' Day, and the only company I had was a boring old Swiss banker.
Anne looked at James and grinned. The waiters cleared the table and wheeled in a trolley bearing a crown of lamb in immaculate cutlet frills, which Harvey studied with great interest.
Still, said Harvey, chattering on, it was thoughtful of you to ring me at Monte Carlo, my dear. I really thought I was going to die, you know. James, you wouldn't have believed it. They removed a gallstone the size of a baseball from my stomach. Thank God the operation was performed by one of the greatest surgeons in the world, Wiley Barker, the president's surgeon. He saved my life.
Harvey promptly undid his shirt and revealed a 4-inch scar across his vast stomach.
What do you think of that, James?
Remarkable.
Daddy, really? We're having dinner.
Stop fussing, honey. It won't be the first time James has seen a man's stomach.
It's not the first time I've seen that one, thought James. Harvey pushed his shirt back into his trousers and continued.
Anyway, it was really kind of you to phone me.
He leaned over and patted her hand.
I was a good boy, too. I took your advice and kept that nice Dr. Barker on for another week in case any complications arose. Mind you, the price, these doctors.
James dropped his wine glass. The claret covered the tablecloth with a red stain.
I'm so sorry.
You all right, James?
Yes, sir.
James looked at Anne in silent outrage. Harvey was quite unperturbed.
Bring a fresh tablecloth and some more wine for Lord Brixley.
The waiter opened a fresh bottle of claret, and James decided it was his turn to have a little fun. Anne had been laughing at him for 3 months. Why shouldn't he tease her a little, if Harvey gave them the chance? Harvey was still talking.
You a racing man, James?
Yes, sir, and I was delighted by your victory in the King George the Sixth and Queen Elizabeth stakes, for more reasons than you realize.
In the diversion caused by the waiters clearing the table, Anne whispered, sotto voce,
Don't try to be too clever, darling. He's not as stupid as he sounds.
Well, what do you think of her?
I beg your pardon, sir.
Rosalie. Magnificent. I put £5 each way on her. Yes, it was a great occasion for me, and I was sorry you missed it, Rosalie, because you would have met the Queen and a nice guy from Oxford University called Professor Porter.
Professor Porter? Inquired James, burying his face in his wine glass.
Yes, Professor Porter, James. Do you know him?
No, sir, I can't say I do. But didn't he win a Nobel Prize?
He sure did, and he gave me a wonderful time at Oxford. I enjoyed myself so much I ended up presenting the university with a check for $250,000, to be used for research of some kind, so he should be happy.
Daddy, you know you're not meant to tell anybody about that.
Sure, but James is family now.
Why can't you tell anyone else, sir?
Well, it's a long story, James, but it was quite an honor for me. You do understand this is highly confidential, but I was Professor Porter's guest at Encinia. I lunched at All Souls with Mr. Harry Macmillan, your dear old Prime Minister, and then I attended the garden party, and afterward I had a meeting with the Vice-Chancellor in his private rooms, along with the Registrar and the Secretary of the University Chest. Were you at Oxford, James?
Yes, sir. The house.
The house? Queried Harvey.
Christchurch, sir.
I'll never understand Oxford.
No, sir.
You must call me Harvey. Well, as I was saying, we all met at the Clarendon, and they stammered and stuttered, and they were totally lost for words, except for one funny old guy, who was 90 if he was a day. The truth is that those people just don't know how to approach millionaires for money, so I put them out of their embarrassment and took over. They'd have gone on all day about their beloved Oxford. So eventually I had to shut them up and simply wrote out a check for $250,000.
That was very generous, Harvey.
I'd have given them $500,000 if the old boy had asked.
James, you've gone quite white. Do you feel all right?
I'm sorry. Yes, I'm fine. I was quite carried away with your description of Oxford.
Anne joined in. Daddy, you made an agreement with the Vice-Chancellor that you would keep your gift as a bond between the university and yourself, and you must promise never to repeat that story again.
I think I shall wear the robes for the first time when I open the new Metcalf Library at Harvard in the fall.
Oh, no, sir, stammered James a little too quickly.
That wouldn't be quite the thing. You should only wear full robes in Oxford on ceremonial occasions.
Gee, what a shame.
Still, I know what sticklers you English are for etiquette, which reminds me we ought to discuss your wedding. I suppose you two will want to live in England.
Yes, Daddy, but we'll visit you every year, and when you make your annual trip to Europe, you can come and stay with us.
The waiters cleared the table again and reappeared with Harvey's favourite strawberries. Anne tried to steer the conversation to domestic issues and stop her father returning to what he'd been up to during the past 2 months, while James spent his time trying to get him back on the subject.
Coffee or liquor, sir?
No, thank you, said Harvey. Just the check. I thought we'd have a drink in my suite at Claridge's, Rosalie. I have something to show you both.
It's a bit of a surprise. I can't wait, Daddy. I love surprises. Come on, James.
James left them and drove the Alfa Romeo to Claridge's garage so that Anne could have a few moments alone with her father. They strolled along Curzon Street, arm in arm.
Isn't he wonderful, Daddy?
Yeah, great guy. Didn't seem too bright to begin with, but he cheered up as the meal went on. And fancy my little girl turning out to be a genuine English lady. Your mama's tickled pink, and I'm pleased that we've patched up our silly quarrel.
Oh, you helped a lot, Daddy.
I did,
queried Harvey.
Yes, I managed to get things back into perspective during the last few weeks. Now, tell me, what is your little surprise?
Wait and see, honey. It's your wedding present.
James rejoined them at the entrance to Claridge's. He could tell from Anne's look that Harvey had given him the seal of parental approval.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening, my lord.
Hi there, Albert. Could you fix some coffee and a bottle of Remy Martin to be sent up to my suite?
Right away, sir.
James had never seen the royal suite before. Off the small entrance, there is a master bedroom on the right and a sitting room on the left. Harvey took them straight to the sitting room.
"Children, you are about to see your wedding present."
He threw the door open in dramatic style, and there on the far wall was the Van Gogh. They both stared, quite unable to speak.
"That's exactly how it left me," said Harvey, speechless.
"Daddy?"
Anne swallowed. "A Van Gogh. But you've always wanted a Van Gogh. You've dreamed of possessing one for years. I couldn't possibly deprive you of it now. And anyway, I couldn't think of having anything as valuable as that in my house. Think of the security risk. We don't have the protection you have," Anne stammered on.
"We couldn't let you sacrifice the pride of your collection, could we, James?"
"Absolutely not," said James with great feeling. "I wouldn't have a moment's peace with that on the premises. Keep the painting in Boston, Daddy, in a setting worthy of it."
"But I thought you'd love the idea, Rosalie."
I do, Daddy. I just don't want the responsibility. And in any case, Mother must have the chance to enjoy it too. You can always leave it to James and me if you like."
"What a great idea, Rosalie. That way we can both enjoy the painting. Now I shall have to think of another wedding present." "She nearly got the better of me then, James, and she hasn't done that in 24 years.
"Well, I've managed it 2 or 3 times lately, Daddy, and I'm still hoping I shall do it once more."
Harvey ignored Anne's remark and went on talking.
"That's the King George and Elizabeth trophy," he said, pointing to a magnificent bronze sculpture of a horse and jockey with his hoop and quartered cap studded with diamonds. "The race is so important they present a new trophy every year, so it's mine for life."
James was thankful that the trophy at least was genuine. The coffee and brandy arrived and they settled down to discuss the wedding in detail.
"Now, Rosalie, you must fly over to Lincoln next week and help your mother with the arrangements. Otherwise she'll panic and nothing will get done. And, James, you let me know how many people you'll have coming over and I'll put them up at the Ritz. The wedding will be in Trinity Church, Copley Square, and we'll have a real English-style reception afterward, back in my home in Lincoln. Does all that make sense, James?"
"Sounds wonderful. You're a very well-organized man, Harvey."
"Always have been, James. Find it pays in the long run. Now, you and Rosalie must get the details sewn up before she comes over next week. You may not have realized it, but I'm returning to America tomorrow."
Page 38A of the blue dossier, thought James. James and Anne spent another hour chatting about the wedding arrangements and left Harvey just before midnight.
"I'll see you first thing in the morning, Daddy."
"Good night, sir."
James shook hands and left.
"I told you he was super."
"He's a fine young man, and your mother will be very pleased."
James said nothing to Anne in the lift on the way down, because two other men stood beside them in silence, also intent on reaching the ground floor. But once they were in the Alfa Romeo, he took Anne by the scruff of her neck, threw her across his legs, and spanked her so hard that she didn't know whether to laugh or cry.
"What's that for? Just in case you ever forget, after we're married, who's the head of this household? You male chauvinist pig! I was only trying to help."
James drove at furious speed to Anne's flat.
"What about all your so-called background? My parents live in Washington, and Daddy's in the diplomatic corps,"
James mimicked.
"Some diplomat. I know, darling, but I had to think of something once I'd realized who it was you were up against. What in hell's name am I going to tell the others?"
"Nothing. You invite them to the wedding. Explain that my mother is American, and that's why we're getting married in Boston. I'd give the earth to see their faces when they discover who your father-in-law is. In any case, you still have a plan to think of, and you can't possibly let them down."
"But the circumstances have changed."
"No, they haven't. The truth of the matter is that they've all succeeded, and you've failed. So you be sure you think of a plan by the time you reach America."
"It's obvious now that we wouldn't have succeeded without your help."
"Nonsense, darling. I had nothing to do with Jean-Pierre's scheme. I just added some background color here and there. Promise you'll never spank me again."
"Certainly I will, every time I think of that picture. But now, darling..."
"James, you're a sex maniac."
"I know, darling. How do you think we Briggsleys have reared tribes of little lords for generations?"
Anne left James early the next morning to spend some time with her father, and they both saw him off at the airport on the midday flight to Boston. Anne could not resist asking in the car on the way back what James had decided to tell the others. She could get no response other than, "Wait and see. I'm not having it changed behind my back. I'm only too glad you're off to America on Monday." Chapter 18. Monday was a double hell for James. First, he had to see Anne off on the morning TWA flight for Boston, and then he had to spend the rest of the day preparing for the team meeting in the evening. The other three had now completed their operations and would be waiting to hear what he had to come up with. It was twice as hard, now he knew that the victim was to be his father-in-law, but he realized that Anne was right, and he could not put that forward as an excuse. Nevertheless, he still had to relieve Harvey of $250,000. To think he could have done it with one sentence at Oxford. That was another thing he could not tell the rest of the team. As Oxford had been Stephen's victory, the team dinner was at Magdalen College, and James travelled out of London just after the rush hour, past the White City Stadium, and on down the M40 to Oxford. "You're always last, James," said Stephen. "Sorry, I've been up to my eyes." "Preparing a good plan, I hope," said Jean-Pierre. James didn't answer. How well they all knew each other now, he thought. In 12 weeks, James felt he had come to know more about these three men than any of the so-called friends he'd known for 20 years. For the first time, he understood why his father continually referred back to friendships formed during the war, with men he normally would never have met. He began to realize how much he was going to miss Stephen when he returned to America. Success was, in fact, going to split them up. James would have been the last to go through the agony of another prospector oil, but it had certainly had its compensations. Stephen could never treat any occasion as a celebration, and as soon as the servants had brought in the first course and left, he banged the table with a spoon and declared that the meeting was in progress.
"Make me a promise," said Jean-Pierre.
"What's that?" asked Stephen.
"When we have every last penny back, I can sit at the top of the table, and you won't speak until you're spoken to."
"Agreed," said Stephen, "but not until we do have every last penny. The position at the moment is that we've received $777,560. Expenses on this operation have totaled $5,178, making a grand total of $27,661.24. Therefore, Metcalf still owes us $250,101.24. Stephen handed around a copy of the current balance sheet. "These sheets are to be added to your own folders as pages 63C. Any questions?"
"Yes. Why were the expenses so high for this operation?" asked Robin.
"Well, over and above the obvious things," said Stephen. "The truth is that we've been hit by the floating exchange rate of sterling against the dollar. At the beginning of this operation, you could get $2.44 to the pound. This morning, I could only get $2.32. I'm spending in pounds, but charging Metcalf in dollars at the going rate."
"Not going to let him off with one penny, are you?" said James.
"Not one penny. Now, before we go on, I should like to place on record..."
"This gets more like a meeting of the House of Commons every time," said Jean-Pierre.
"Stop croaking, frog," said Robin.
"Listen, you Harley Street pimp."
Uproar broke out. The college scouts, who had seen some rowdy gatherings in their time, wondered if they would have to be called in to help before the evening was completed.
"Quiet!"
The sharp senatorial voice of Stephen brought them all back to order.
"I know you're in high spirits, but we still have to get $250,101.24. We must on no account forget the 24 cents, Stephen. You weren't as noisy the first time you had dinner here, Jean-Pierre. The man that once did sell the lion's skin while the beast lived was killed with hunting him."
The table went silent. "Harvey still owes the team money, and it'll be just as hard to acquire the last quarter as it was with the first three quarters. Before I hand over to James, I'd like to place on record that his performance at the Clarendon was nothing less than brilliant." Robin and Jean-Pierre banged the table in appreciation and agreement. "Now, James, we're all ears."
Once again, the room fell into silence.
"My plan is nearly complete," began James.
The others looked disbelieving.
"But I have something to tell you, which I hope will allow me a short respite before we carry it out."
"You're going to get married."
"Quite right, Jean-Pierre, as usual.
I could tell the moment you walked in."
"When do we meet her, James?"
"Not until it's too late for her to change her mind, Jean-Pierre." Stephen consulted his diary.
"How much reprieve are you asking for?"
"Well, Anne and I are getting married on August 3rd in Boston. Anne's mother is American," explained James. "And although Anne lives in England, it would please her mother if she was married at home. Then there'll be the honeymoon, and after that we anticipate returning to England on August 25th. My plan for Mr. Metcalf ought to be carried out on September 15th, the closing day of the stock exchange account."
"I'm sure that's acceptable, James."
All agreed. Robin and Jean-Pierre nodded. James launched into his plan.
"I shall require a telex and 7 telephones. They'll need to be installed in my flat. Jean-Pierre will have to be in Paris at the Bourse, Stephen in Chicago on the commodity market, and Robin in London at Lloyd's. I will present a full blue dossier as soon as I return from my honeymoon."
They were all struck dumb with admiration, and James paused for dramatic effect.
"Very good, James," said Stephen. "We'll await the details with interest.
What further instructions do you have?"
"First, Stephen, you must know the opening and closing price of gold in Johannesburg, Zurich, New York, and London each day for the next month. Jean-Pierre, you must know the price of the Deutschmark, the French franc, and the pound against the dollar every day during the same period. And Robin must master a telex machine and PBX 8-line switchboard by September 2nd. You must be as competent as an international operator."
"Always get the easy jobs, Robin, don't you?" said Jean-Pierre.
"You can shut up, both of you," said James. Their faces registered surprise and respect. "I've made notes for all of you to work on." James handed 2 typewritten sheets to each member of the team. "You add these to your dossiers at pages 74 and 75, and they should keep you occupied for at least a month. Finally, you're all invited to the wedding of Miss Anne Summerton to James Briggsley. I shan't bother issuing you with formal invitations at such short notice, but I've reserved seats for us on a 7:47 on the afternoon of August 2nd, and we're all booked in at the Ritz in Boston for the night. I hope you'll honour me by being ushers." Even James was impressed by his own efficiency. The others received the plane tickets and instructions with astonishment. "We'll meet at the airport at 3 p.m. and during the flight I shall test you on your dossier notes."
"Yes, sir," said Jean-Pierre.
"Your test, Jean-Pierre, will be in both French and English, as you'll be required to converse in 2 languages over a transatlantic telephone and appear expert on foreign currency exchange." There were no more jokes about James that evening, and as he travelled back up the motorway he felt a new man. Not only had he been the star of the Oxford plan, now he had the other 3 on the run. He would come out on top and do his old pa yet.
Chapter 19. For a change, James was the first to arrive at a meeting, and the others joined him at Heathrow. He had gained the upper hand and was determined not to lose it. Robin arrived last, clutching an armful of newspapers.
"We're only going to be away for 2 days," said Stephen.
"I know, but I always miss the English papers, so I've brought enough for tomorrow as well."
Jean-Pierre threw his arms up in Gallic despair. They checked their luggage through the number 3 terminal and boarded the British Airways 747 flight to Logan International Airport.
"It's more like a football ground,"
said Robin, stepping for the first time inside a jumbo jet.
"It holds 350 people, about the size of the crowds most of your English clubs deserve," said Jean-Pierre.
"Cut it out," said James sternly,
not realizing that they were both nervous passengers and were only trying to relieve the tension. Later, during takeoff, they both pretended to read, but as soon as the plane reached 30,000 feet, and the little white light that says fastened seatbelt switched off, they were back in top form. The team chewed its way stolidly through a plastic dinner of cold chicken and Algerian red wine.
"I do hope, James,"
said Jean-Pierre, that your father-in-law will feed us a little better. After the meal, James allowed them to watch the film, but insisted that as soon as it was over they must prepare to be tested one by one. Robin and Jean-Pierre moved back 15 rows to watch the sting. Stephen stayed in his seat to be grilled by James. James handed Stephen a typewritten sheet of 40 questions on the price of gold all over the world and the market movements during the past 4 weeks. Stephen completed it in 22 minutes, and it came as no surprise to James to find that every answer was correct. Stephen had always been the backbone of the team, and it was his logical brain that had really defeated Harvey Metcalf. Stephen and James dozed intermittently until Robin and Jean-Pierre returned, when they were given their 40 questions. Robin took 30 minutes over his and scored 38 out of 40. Jean-Pierre took 27 minutes and scored 37.
"Stephen got 40 out of 40, said James.
"He would," said Jean-Pierre.
Robin looked a little sheepish.
"And so will you by September 2nd. Understood?"
They both nodded.
"Have you seen the sting?" asked Robin.
"No," replied Stephen. "I rarely go to the cinema."
"They're not in our league. One big operation and they don't even keep the money."
"Go to sleep, Robin." The meal, the film, and James's quizzes had taken up most of the 6-hour flight, and they all nodded off in the last hour, to be woken up suddenly by,
"This is your captain speaking. We are approaching Logan International Airport, and our flight is running 20 minutes late. We expect to land at 7:15 in approximately 10 minutes. We hope you have enjoyed your flight and will travel again with British Airways."
Customs took a little longer than usual, as they all three had brought presents for the wedding and did not want James to know what they were. They had considerable trouble in explaining to the customs officer why one of the 2 Piaget watches had inscribed on the back, "Part of the illicit profits from Prospector Oil," the 3 who had plans. When they finally escaped the customs official, they found Anne standing at the entrance by a large Cadillac waiting to chauffeur them to the hotel.
"Now we know why it took you so long to come up with something. You were genuinely distracted. Congratulations, James. You're entirely forgiven," said Jean-Pierre, and threw his arms around Anne as only a Frenchman could.
Robin introduced himself and kissed her gently on the cheek. Stephen shook hands with her rather formally. They bustled into the car, Jean-Pierre sitting next to Anne.
"Miss Somerton," stuttered Stephen, "do call me Anne."
"Will the reception be at the hotel?"
"No," replied Anne, "at my parents' house. But there'll be a car to pick you up and take you there after the wedding. Your only responsibility is to see that James gets to the church by 3:30. Other than that, you have nothing to worry about. While I think of it, James, your father and mother arrived yesterday and they're staying with my parents. We thought it might not be a good idea for you to spend this evening at home, because mother's flapping about everything."
"Anything you say, darling.
If you should change your mind between now and tomorrow," said Jean-Pierre, "I find myself available. I may not be blessed with noble blood, but there are 1 or 2 compensations we French can always offer."
Anne smiled to herself.
"You're a little late, Jean-Pierre. In any case, I don't like beards."
"But I only..." began Jean-Pierre.
The others glared at him. At the hotel, they left Anne and James alone while they went to unpack.
"Do they know, darling?"
"They haven't the slightest idea," replied James. "They're going to get the surprise of their life tomorrow."
"Is your plan ready?"
"Wait and see."
"Well, I have one," said Anne. "When's yours scheduled for?"
"September 13th.
"I win then. Mine's for tomorrow."
"What? You were meant to..."
"Don't worry. You just concentrate on getting married. To me."
"Can't we go somewhere?"
"No, you terrible man. You can wait until tomorrow."
"I do love you."
"Go to bed, you silly thing. I love you too. But I must go home, otherwise nothing'll be ready."
James took the lift to the 7th floor and joined the others for coffee.
"Anyone for blackjack?"
"Not with you, you pirate," said Robin. "You've been tutored by the biggest crook alive." The team were in top form and looking forward to the wedding. In spite of the transatlantic time dislocation, they didn't depart for their separate rooms until well after midnight. Even then, James lay awake for some time,
turning over the same question in his mind. I wonder what she's up to this time.
Chapter 20. Boston in August is as beautiful a city as any in America, and the team enjoyed a large breakfast in James's room.
I don't think he looks up to it, said Jean-Pierre. You're the captain of the team, Stephen. I volunteer to take his place.
It'll cost you $250,000.
Agreed, said Jean-Pierre.
You don't have $250,000, said Stephen.
You have $187,474.69, being one quarter of what's been raised so far. So my decision is that James must be the bridegroom.
It's an Anglo-Saxon plot, said Jean-Pierre,
and when James has successfully completed his plan and we have the full amount, I shall reopen negotiations.
They sat talking and laughing for a long time over the toast and coffee. Stephen regarded them fondly, regretting how rarely they would meet once, if, he corrected himself sternly, James's operation were accomplished successfully. If Harvey Metcalf had ever had a team like this on his side, instead of against him, he would have been the richest man in the world.
You're dreaming, Stephen.
Yes, I'm sorry. I mustn't forget that Anne has put me in charge.
Here we go again, said Jean-Pierre.
What time shall we report, Professor?
1 hour from now, fully dressed to inspect James and take him to the church. Jean-Pierre, you will go and buy 4 carnations, 3 red ones and 1 white. Robin, you will arrange for the taxi and I shall take care of James. Robin and Jean-Pierre left, singing the Marseillaise lustily in 2 different keys. James and Stephen watched them depart.
How are you feeling, James?
Great. I'm only sorry that I didn't complete my plan before today.
Doesn't matter at all. September 13th will be quite early enough. In any case, the break will do us no harm.
We'd never have managed it without you.
You know that, don't you, Stephen?
We'd all be facing ruin, and I wouldn't even have met Anne. We all owe you so much.
Stephen stared fixedly out of the window, unable to reply.
3 red and 1 white, said Jean-Pierre, as instructed, and I presume the white one is for me.
Pin it on James, not behind his ear, Jean-Pierre.
You look fantastic, but I still fail to see what the lady sees in you, said Jean-Pierre,
fixing the white carnation in James's buttonhole. Although the 4 of them were ready to leave, they still had 30 minutes to kill before the taxi was due. Jean-Pierre opened a bottle of champagne and they toasted James's health, the team's health, Her Majesty the Queen, the President of the United States, and finally, with simulated reluctance, the President of France. Having finished the bottle, Stephen thought it wise for them to leave immediately and dragged the other 3 down to the waiting taxi.
Keep smiling, James. We're with you.
And they bundled him into the back. The taxi took only a few minutes to reach Trinity Church, Copley Square, and the driver was not unhappy to be rid of the 4 of them.
3:15 p.m. Anne will be very pleased with me, said Stephen.
He escorted the bridegroom to the front pew on the right-hand side of the church, while Jean-Pierre made eyes at the prettiest of the girls. Robin helped hand out the wedding sheets, while 1,000 overdressed guests waited for the bride. Stephen had just come to Robin's aid on the steps of the church, and Jean-Pierre had joined them, suggesting they take their seats, when the Rolls-Royce arrived. They were riveted to the steps by the beauty of Anne in her Balenciaga wedding gown. Her father stepped out behind her. She took his arm and proceeded to climb the steps. The 3 stood motionless, like sheep in the stare of a python.
The bastard! Who's been conning who? She must have known all along.
Harvey beamed vaguely at them as he walked past with Anne on his arm. They proceeded down the aisle.
Good God! Thought Stephen. He didn't recognize any of us.
They took their places at the back of the church, out of earshot of the vast congregation. The organist stopped playing when Anne reached the altar.
Harvey can't know, said Stephen. How do you work that out?
Asked Jean-Pierre. Because James would never have put us through this unless he'd passed the test himself at some earlier date.
Good thinking, whispered Robin.
I require and charge you both, as ye will answer at the dreadful day of judgment, when the secrets of all hearts shall be disclosed.
I'd like to know one or two secrets right now, said Jean-Pierre. To start with, how long has she known?
James Clarence Spencer, wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife, to live together after God's ordinance in the holy estate of matrimony? Wilt thou love her, comfort her, honor and keep her in sickness and in health, and, forsaking all other, keep thee only unto her, so long as ye both shall live?
I will.
Rosalie Arlene, wilt thou have this man to thy wedded husband, to live?
I think, said Stephen, we can be sure that she's a fully-fledged member of the team. Otherwise we could never have succeeded at Monte Carlo or Oxford.
So long as ye both shall live.
I will.
Who giveth this woman to be married to this man?
Harvey bustled forward and took Anne's hand and gave it to the priest.
I, James Clarence Spencer, take thee, Rosalie Arlene, to my wedded wife.
And what's more, why should he recognize us when he's only seen each of us once, and not as we really are? Continued Stephen.
And thereto I plight thee my troth. I, Rosalie Arlene, take thee, James Clarence Spencer, to my wedded husband.
But he must have a chance of working it out if we hang around, said Robin.
Not necessarily, said Stephen. No need to panic. Our secret has always been to catch him off home ground.
But now he's on home ground, said Jean-Pierre.
No, he isn't. It's his daughter's wedding day, and it's totally strange to the man. Naturally, we avoid him at the reception, but we don't make it too obvious.
You'll have to hold my hand, said Robin.
I will, volunteered Jean-Pierre. Just remember to act naturally.
And thereto, I give thee my troth.
Anne was quiet and shy, her voice only just reaching the astonished three at the back. James was clear and firm.
With this ring I thee wed, with my body I thee worship, and with all my worldly goods I thee endow.
And with some of ours, too, said Jean-Pierre.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Let us pray, intoned the priest.
I know what I'm going to pray, said Robin,
to be delivered out of the power of our enemy and from the hands of all that hate us.
O eternal God, creator and preserver of all mankind,
we're near the end now, said Stephen.
An unfortunate turn of phrase, offered Robin.
Silence, said Jean-Pierre. I agree with Stephen. We've got the measure of Metcalf. Just relax.
Those whom God hath joined together, let no man put asunder.
Jean-Pierre continued mumbling to himself, but it didn't sound like a prayer. The blast of Handel's wedding march from the organ brought them all back to the occasion. The ceremony was over, and Lord and Lady Briggsley walked down the aisle, watched by 2,000 smiling eyes. Stephen looked amused, Jean-Pierre envious, and Robin nervous. James smiled beatifically as he passed them. After a 10-minute session for the photographers on the steps of the church, the Rolls-Royce carried the newly married couple back to the Metcalfe's house in Lincoln. Harvey and the Countess of Louth took the second car, and the Earl and Arlene, Anne's mother, took the third. Stephen, Robin, and Jean-Pierre followed some 20 minutes later, still arguing the pros and cons of bearding the lion in his own den. Harvey Metcalfe's Georgian house was magnificent, with an oriental garden leading down to a lake, great beds of roses, and in the conservatory his pride and joy, his collection of rare orchids.
I never thought I'd see this, said Jean-Pierre.
Nor me, said Robin, and now that I have, I'm not too happy.
Let's run the gauntlet, said Stephen.
I suggest that we join the receiving line at well-separated intervals.
I'll go first. Robin, you come second, at least 20 places behind. And Jean-Pierre, you come third, at least 20 places behind Robin. And act naturally.
We're just friends of James's from England.
Now, when you take your places in the queue, listen to the conversation. Try and find someone who's a close friend of Harvey's, and jump immediately in front of them. When it comes to your turn to shake hands, Harvey's eyes will already be on the next person, because he won't know you and will want to talk to them. That way we should escape.
Brilliant, Professor, said Jean-Pierre.
The queue seemed interminably long. 1,000 people shuffled past the outstretched hands of Mr. and Mrs. Metcalfe, the Earl and Countess of Louth, and Anne and James. Stephen eventually made it and passed with flying colours.
So glad you could come, said Anne.
Stephen did not reply.
Good to see you, Stephen.
We all admire your plan, James.
Stephen slipped into the main ballroom and hid behind a pillar on the other side of the room, as far as he could be from the multi-story wedding cake in the centre. Robin was next, and avoided looking Harvey in the eyes.
How kind of you to come all this way, said Anne.
Robin mumbled something under his breath.
Hope you've enjoyed yourself today, Robin.
James was obviously having the time of his life. After being put through it in the same way by Anne, he was relishing the team's discomfiture.
You're a bastard, James.
Not too loud, old fellow. My mother and father might hear you. Robin slipped through to the ballroom and, after a search behind all the pillars, found Stephen.
Did you get through all right?
I think so, but I don't want to see him ever again. What time is the plane back?
8 p.m. Now don't panic. Keep your eye out for Jean-Pierre. Bloody good thing he kept his beard, said Robin.
Jean-Pierre shook hands with Harvey, who was already intent on the next guest, as Jean-Pierre had, by shameless cue-barging, managed to secure a place in front of a Boston banker, who was obviously a close friend of Harvey's.
Good to see you, Marvin.
Jean-Pierre had escaped. He kissed Anne on both cheeks, whispered in her ear,
a game set and match to James,
and went off in search of Stephen and Robin. He forgot his original instructions when he found himself face to face with the chief bridesmaid.
Did you enjoy the wedding?
She asked.
Of course. I always judge weddings by the bridesmaids, not the bride.
She blushed with pleasure.
This must have cost a fortune, she continued.
Yes, my dear, and I know whose, said Jean-Pierre, slipping his arm around her waist.
Four hands grabbed the protesting Jean-Pierre and unceremoniously dragged him behind the pillar.
For God's sake, Jean-Pierre, she's not a day over 17. We don't want to go to jail for rape of a juvenile as well as theft. Drink this and behave yourself.
Robin thrust a glass of champagne into his hand. The champagne flowed and even Stephen had a little too much. They were all clinging to their pillar for support by the time the toastmaster called for silence.
My lords, ladies and gentlemen, pray silence for the Viscount Briggsley, the bridegroom.
James made an impressive speech. The actor in him took over and the Americans adored it. Even his father had a look of admiration on his face. The toastmaster then introduced Harvey, who spoke long and loud. He cracked his favourite joke about marrying off his daughter to Prince Charles, at which the assembled guests roared heartily, as they always do at weddings, even for the weakest joke. He ended by calling the toast for the bride and groom. When the applause had died down, and the hubbub of chatter had struck up again, Harvey took an envelope from his pocket and kissed his daughter on the cheek.
Rosalie, here's a little wedding present for you, to make up for letting me keep the Vangle. I know you'll put it to good use.
Harvey passed her the white envelope. Inside there was a check for $250,000. Anne kissed her father with genuine affection.
Thank you, Daddy. I promise you James and I will use it wisely.
She hurried off in pursuit of James, whom she found besieged by a group of American matrons.
Is it true you're related to the Queen?
I never met a real live lord.
I do hope you'll invite us over to see your castle.
There are no castles in the King's Road, said James, relieved to be rescued by Anne.
Darling, can you spare me a minute?
James excused himself and followed Anne, but they found it almost impossible to escape the crowd.
Look, she said, quickly.
James took the check.
Good God! $250,000!
You know what I'm going to do with it, don't you?
Yes, darling.
Anne hunted for Stephen, Robin, and Jean-Pierre, which was not an easy task as they were still hidden behind a pillar in the far corner. She was eventually guided to the spot by the subdued but spirited rendering of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, issuing from behind it.
"Can you lend me a pen, Stephen?"
Three pens shot out for her use. She took the check from the middle of her bouquet and wrote on its back, "Rosalie Briggsley, pay Stephen Bradley." She handed it to him.
"Yours, I believe."
The three of them stared at the check. She was gone before they could even comment.
"What a girl our James has gone and married," said Jean-Pierre.
"You're drunk, you frog," said Robin.
"How dare you, sir, suggest that a Frenchman could get drunk on champagne? I demand satisfaction. Choose your weapons."
"Champagne corks."
"Quiet," said Stephen. "You'll give yourselves away."
"Well, now, tell me, Professor, what's the latest financial position?"
"I'm just working it out now," said Stephen.
"What?"
said Robin and Jean-Pierre together, but they were too happy to argue.
"He still owes us $101.24.
"Disgraceful," said Jean-Pierre. "Burn the place down."
Anne and James left to change, while Stephen, Robin and Jean-Pierre forced down some more champagne. The toastmaster announced that the bride and groom would be leaving in approximately 15 minutes, and requested the guests to gather in the main hall and courtyard.
"Come on, we must watch them go,"
said Stephen. The drink had given them new confidence, and they took their places near the car. It was Stephen who heard Harvey say,
"God damn it, do I have to think of everything?"
and watched him look around his guests until his eyes fell on the trio. Stephen's legs turned to jelly as Harvey's finger beckoned him.
"Hey, you, weren't you an usher?"
"Yes, sir."
"Rosalie is going to leave at any moment, and there are no flowers for her. God knows what's happened to them, but there are no flowers. Grab a car. There's a florist half a mile down the road. But hurry."
"Yes, sir."
"Say, don't I know you from somewhere?"
"Yes, sir. I mean, no, sir. I'll go and get the flowers."
Stephen turned and fled. Robin and Jean-Pierre, who had been watching horrified, thinking that Harvey had at last rumbled them, ran after him. When he reached the back of the house, Stephen came to a halt and stared at the most beautiful bed of roses. Robin and Jean-Pierre shot straight past him, stopped, turned around and staggered back.
"What the hell are you up to? Picking flowers for your own funeral?"
"It's only Metcalf's wishes. Somebody forgot the flowers for Anne, and I have 5 minutes to get them, so start picking."
"Mes enfants, do you see what I see?"
The others looked up. Jean-Pierre was staring rapturously at the conservatory. Stephen rushed back to the front of the house, the prize orchids in his arms, followed by Robin and Jean-Pierre. He was just in time to pass them over to Harvey before James and Anne came out of the house.
"Magnificent. They're my favorite flowers. How much were they?"
$100, replied Stephen without thinking. Harvey handed over $2 $50 bills. Stephen retreated, sweating, to join Robin and Jean-Pierre. James and Dan fought their way through the crowd. No man in the gathering could take his eyes off her.
"Oh, Daddy, orchids, how beautiful."
Anne kissed Harvey.
"You've made this the most wonderful day in my life."
The Rolls-Royce moved slowly down the drive, away from the large crowd, on its way to the airport, where James and Anne were to catch the flight to San Francisco, their first stop on the way to Hawaii. As the car glided round the house, Anne stared at the empty conservatory, and then at the flowers in her arms. James did not notice. He was thinking of other things.
"Do you think they'll ever forgive me?"
he said.
"I'm sure they'll find a way, darling. But do let me into a secret. Did you really have a plan? I knew you wouldn't be able to resist asking me that. And the truth is..."
The car purred effortlessly along the highway, and only the chauffeur heard his reply. Stephen, Robin, and Jean-Pierre watched the guests dispersing, most of them saying their goodbyes to the Metcalfs.
"Don't let's risk it," said Robin.
"Agreed," said Stephen.
"Let's invite him out to dinner," said Jean-Pierre.
The other two grabbed him and threw him into a taxi.
"What's that you have under your morning coat, Jean-Pierre?
2 bottles of Krug 1964. It seems such a shame to leave them there on their own. I thought they might get lonely."
Stephen instructed the driver to take them back to the hotel.
"What a wedding! Do you think James ever had a plan?"
asked Robin.
"I don't know. But if he has, it will only have to bring in $1.24. We should have retrieved the money he made from his win on Rosalie at Ascot," mused Jean-Pierre.
After packing and signing out of the hotel, they took another taxi to Logan International Airport and, with considerable help from the British Airways staff, managed to board the plane.
"Damn," said Stephen. "I wish we hadn't left without the $1.24.
Chapter 21. Once on board, they drank the champagne Jean-Pierre had captured at the wedding. Even Stephen seemed content, although he did occasionally revert to the theme of the missing $1.24.
"How much do you imagine this champagne cost?" teased Jean-Pierre.
"That's not the point. Not a penny more, not a penny less." Jean-Pierre decided he would never understand academics.
"Don't worry, Stephen. I've every confidence that James's plan will bring in $1.24.
Stephen would have laughed, but it gave him a headache.
To think that girl knew everything.
On arrival at Heathrow, they had little trouble in clearing customs. The purpose of the trip had never been to bring back gifts. Robin made a detour to W.H. Smith's and picked up the Times and the Evening Standard. Jean-Pierre bargained with a taxi driver about the fare to central London.
"We're not some bloody Americans who don't know the rate or the route and can be easily fleeced," he was saying,
still not yet sober. The taxi driver grumbled to himself as he nosed his black Austin toward the motorway. It was not going to be his day. Robin read the papers happily, one of those rare people who could read in a moving car. Stephen and Jean-Pierre satisfied themselves with watching the passing traffic.
"Jesus Christ!"
Stephen and Jean-Pierre were startled. They had rarely heard Robin swear. It seemed out of character.
"God almighty!"
This was too much for them, but before they could inquire, he began to read out loud,
"BP announced a strike in the North Sea, which is likely to produce 200,000 barrels of oil a day. The strike is described by their chairman, Sir Eric Drake, as a major find. The British Petroleum Forties field is 1 mile from the so far unexplored Prospector oil field, and rumours of a bid by BP have sent Prospector oil shares to a record high of $12.25 at the close of business."
"Nom de Dieu," said Jean-Pierre. "What do we do now?"
"Oh, well," said Stephen. "I suppose we'll have to work out a plan for how to give it all back."
We hope you've enjoyed Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less, a Macmillan audiobook production from St. Martin's Press. Text copyright 1976 by Geoffrey Archer. Production copyright 2014 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.